Well, I changed sermon titles from death and taxes to the IMUS mess and the question of whether this is a teaching learning moment for our society. Easy answer is, I don't know, but it could be. First of all, I assume all of you know what I'm talking about the IMUS mess. Here is somebody that's for years and years spoke in racial, religious, ethnic stereotyping, made jokes, most of them not jokes, just silly, stupid name-calling, and he went over the line. He went way over the line. He obliterated the line. He didn't hit a bump of the road. He drove off the road into a tremendous mess. There's an opportunity in this mess for learning, for real conversation. Something good can come of this. But the first thing to remember, as far as I'm concerned, this is not about IMUS. I may be deconstructing what he said, what he did, what the reactions were, what the hypocrisy may be, but IMUS is not important. He will land another contract. He will work as much as he wants to work. He is a commodity, and he sells advertising. And what it means about what sells in our society and the course level of discourse is much more important than the fate of Don IMUS. First of all, let me say this. This is not a free speech issue. I really believe in free speech. I'm a radical free speech person. But to be free to speak is to be free to speak unrestrained by the government. There is no First Amendment, Second Amendment, any amendment right to be published, to have a radio show. I have tried to convince various newspapers that they have the affirmative responsibility of publishing everything that I write. So far, I have done a pretty good job with one paper that Sharon has bought my lie, and another paper buys about 80% of what I write. But I don't have a right to be published. I have a right to write. I have a right to speak. I have a right to seek a marketplace. But private businesses do not have an affirmative obligation to print, publish, give a microphone to anybody who shows up. Somebody could show up at our door and say, I have a free speech right to tell you that you're all a bunch of sinners and you are going to be with Susan and need air conditioning in the afterlife because it's going to be really warm. Well, they have a free speech right to say that. They have a free speech right not to have the government tell them to shut up. We have no affirmative obligation of handing them the microphone. So let's be really clear that IMUS gets to say and think what he wants without going to jail. But it doesn't give him a right to spew stereotypes and hatred. He acted like he didn't get it, like he didn't know what it was about. You know, I'm a humorist. Well, no. He broke the first rule of comedy. He wasn't funny. There was nothing funny about calling a group of girls nappy-headed hoes. Where was the humor in that? Now, as people have complained, and the number one complaint about how this discussion has gone is, it's not a level playing field. How come they get to say all these terrible things in rap music? Let me say this. Rap music doesn't get a bum rap. It gets the right rap. Most of it is vulgar, and I have difficulty understanding it as music, but that's the computer chip in my brain that kind of aged out sometime when Pentium 2s came along. So I'm not willing to pass that it's absolutely not music. I am willing to say it is absolutely vulgar and demeaning to women, to men, to people of color. It's racist and it is nauseating. And I don't like it. I don't approve of it. They have a right to sing it. I don't know that the major white-owned music corporations have to make their money on it. I think they are the ones who are, pardon the expression, pimping. It's the major corporations doing the pimping. But there are lots of black artists and one or two white artists who do this kind of stuff. It's legal. It probably should be legal. But it's despicable whether it's being done by a person of color or one of the beige pink people. It just isn't right. But it is somewhat different. It is different when you are talking to family and when you are not talking to family. I can call my children little rotten, spoiled ingrates. Not that I would, and not that they are. It's only an example. Really, it's only an example. But I can do that. But if you call any of my perfect, precious children even rude, I will jump on you and hit you upside the head really good. Because there's a difference between what I get to say in my family and what you get to say about my family. They're not the same. I may be a miserable and abusive parent, but please, not that I am, but I can say things and do things and threaten things that you can't. And the same holds true for you. There are different levels of communication and a different social contract within family and outside of family. So part of it is, as far as I know, Imus was not a part of the family that he was criticizing. Secondly, there's the power imbalance. It is one thing when the powerless make fun of and satirize the establishment. It is one thing when the jester standing outside the gates says the emperor has no clothes on. It is one thing when you are taking on your equal or your superior. It is quite another when, to use the vernacular, the man takes on the powerless. When the rich, white, famous, and with a microphone not only picks on people who are less powerful traditionally by dint of race and heritage, but actually by dint of, these were civilian young women. They were not public figures. Now, we might be having a different conversation if he had said those same words about Condi Rice. And this, I suspect this congregation might have reacted somewhat differently. But it would still have been wrong. But at least it would have been between arguably equals. The power imbalance would not have been as ridiculous and inappropriate as this was. Not only do you have the power imbalance, but these girls were not public figures. They weren't a famous rock band. It wasn't Britney Spears, it wasn't Beyonce, it wasn't any Shakira, it wasn't anyone who had exposed themselves to be commented on one way or another by the public. They had a right and an expectation not to have somebody use racist, sexist, and let me add, if you hear the whole quote, homophobic characterizations. Because he was comparing them to the tattooed NBA players and thugs, and there were issues of their sexuality, and it was the trifecta. It was a power imbalance. It was racial stereotyping. Well, what about the truth to the matter? Well, ho seems completely inappropriate, doesn't it? And this is not ho, ho, ho. This is not hoeing a road. It is a shortened form of whore. Well, but people say that. It's a synonym for women in rap music. Well, why would anybody think that it was okay to say that? Why would you characterize non-public figures whom you do not know with that epithet? Now, there is one semi-valid defense, and that is the line of where the line is blurred to some extent because you hear people use it, you hear it used as a synonym, and you think, okay, those are the rules. Somewhere between 60 and 80% of the rap music bought is bought by white boys. That's terrible. As bad and as corrosive as the music is to the black community, those messages and those videos seem to give the message that ho is just a synonym for woman. It's not, and it's not okay. But how about the nappy-headed? Well, gee, I don't know. Some African-Americans have nappy hair. That's objectively true. So what's wrong with it if it's objectively true? It has weight and baggage. It is a classical racial epithet. Stereotypes, even if they are true or they are based on true, even if they seem to be complimentary, are still demeaning. Recently, a black athlete, actually a coach, said, well, I'm not worried about this. I got a bunch of crafty Jew lawyers. I didn't read that as a compliment. Even putting crafty or smart, even a positive stereotype is very problematic. It's certainly problematic for those Jewish lawyers who are not crafty or not smart. It's problematic for when you look at all of the various racial epithets. My God, what happens in this world to dumb Jews? Look at the expectations to unindustrious Asians. What happens to people of color who can't dance or aren't natural athletes? All of these seeming compliments are demeaning because they deal with a group of people and they erase the individuality of the person. It is not just a description. Not only is it not simply a description to say nappy-headed, but it has huge history and connotations. There is, or was in our old hymnal, the hymn Light of Ages and of Nations. Nice words, beautiful music. The beautiful music was by Haydn. And unfortunately, the beautiful music that it was associated with is Deutschland, Deutschland über alles. I can't hear that as music. It doesn't make any difference what Haydn's intent was. The music picked up baggage by use. The term nappy-headed picks up baggage by use, being used to demean people. Even the N-word you can explain as having a Latin origin. It simply is related to the Latin word for black. But nobody here would argue the etymology as opposed to the historic use, and we would be right. It is a terrible, demeaning word and terrible, demeaning stereotypes. And we have to deal with the fact that here was, this is why he's been doing it for 20, 30 years, and this time it was too much. It was the power imbalance. It was race, ethnicity. It was homophobia. It was misogyny. It was all of those things. And he threw in the nappy-headed as the physical descriptor. Let me go to my smart Jew lawyer again. My smart Jew lawyer might be a bad thing to say. This coach may or may not survive that. But if the coach had said, my smart, hook-nosed Jew lawyer, wouldn't we all immediately understand that had raised the stakes, that had made the demeaning of the individual greater. The truth of the matter, maybe he has a hooked nose. So, we understand that as you pile these on, from race to class to physical description to gender, we have created, or in this case, I'm has created, a critical mass that blew him up. And as far as I'm concerned, it was appropriate for it to blow him up. But now is the big question. Is there some truth and learning that can go on, or simply finger-pointing and spinning with the usual finger-pointing and spinning? And the usual finger-pointing and spinning is very easy. It's a technique that you learn in finger-point spinning 101. It is, no, but the real question is Al Sharpton. No, the real question is the corporate sponsors. No, the real question is, and there are all these distractions. It is not that the distractions are not legitimate topics in themselves, but they are used to take you off the message. Anybody here ever had a fight with a spouse? We all know the technique. You know, honey, you didn't pick up your room. Well, you didn't pick up the car. Honey, you didn't remember to get that. Do you remember last week when you didn't remember to do that? Of course I don't remember, because I didn't remember it then. I don't remember it now. We change the subject to somebody else's fault and somebody else's guilt. It's instinctive, it's instinctual, and it stinks. It just gets us from finishing anything. It would be as if I said, Tim, Brad, why are we showing something on Darfur? There are hungry people here. What good is it going to be to feed people in Darfur if we overheat our atmosphere? We should be talking about global warming. Well, we can't talk about global warming because that's generations from now. We ought to be talking about what's going on right now, and this phobia and that hatred and that need. It doesn't, the needs, the phobias, the problems, they are all there, they are all real, and we need to engage them, but not fall for the let's change the subject and talk about Al Sharpton, because I don't want to talk about Al Sharpton. He has other sins. That's a different sermon. I don't want to talk about Jesse Jackson. Those are other sins. That's a very different sermon. Right now, we in America don't know how to talk about race and ethnicity. We are scared of saying anything meaningful, so we either remain silent or in denial. We simply measure the progress that we have made, which is huge and significant. But it's very hard to have a nuanced, non-shouting conversation where we try to see the mutual humanity and acknowledge the enriching differences. Only 40 years ago today, 40 years is 50, Jackie Robinson, 60. Only 60, you lose track of time, you know. Only 60 years ago today, Jackie Robinson became the first black player in the major leagues in baseball. It was a sin and a crime that it took that long. It was a sin and a crime what he had to go through, what teammates had to go through later on, and other blacks who couldn't stay in the same hotels. The cowardice of many of the sports teams, the Boston Red Sox, the last to integrate. It's shameful. It's shameful. But we have made amazing progress. But we are nowhere near becoming a colorblind society. We are nowhere near a sense of not using color as the key to the assumptions that we make about other people's language ability, intelligence, education, and social class. All of those are real factors in our world, but we get our hints far too many times simply from perceived ethnicity. And we do this on a host. This is just the nature of prejudice. We prejudge by category as opposed to by the experience with the individual. There's an opportunity now. I mentioned today is Holocaust Remembrance Sunday. It is a reminder to us of what happens when we define the other as so wholly other from whatever we are. And we do it by race, we do it by gender, we do it by nationality, we do it in many parts of the world by religion and by religious subsect. We have all different ways of keeping ourselves apart from one another. And the great problem of life, the great problem that we must solve if this experiment called humanity is going to succeed, is how can we truly get to the place, not where we don't make judgments about people, because there are good people and rotten people of all races and religions and nationalities and ethnicities, but how do we get to the point where we really will judge the individual and not the group, where we will understand how much diversity enriches us and doesn't threaten us. And we have a very long way to go. I believe that most of our hatred is based on fear. I think we are, in fact, carefully taught to hate and fear the other. But what the other is highly subjective. What we learn, we can slowly unlearn. And what we have learned that we have not yet unlearned, we can, by act of will, refuse to listen to the worst angels of our nature that want to close our eyes and our hearts to people whom we perceive as the other. I'll close with this quote. I went to hear some years ago Elie Wiesel, and he said, "I don't understand why we hate and despise the other. When I see someone who's different, I immediately want to leave my group and I want to go over and I want to sit down with him or her or them and learn something." This is an opportunity that we have to learn something. I hope we do it not simply alone in our own heads and hearts, but in an honorable conversation amongst different groups.